versus reliable research. All right, counsel.
May it please the court.
Ms. Ibach.
I'm Bob Jones, and I represent Appellant Intervenor Security Union Title Insurance Company.
Well, that's good, Mr. Jones, because I have a question for you about your jurisdictional allegations. If I look at appendix page 12, this is the basic second amended complaint. It says in paragraph 1, plaintiff is TIG, an insurance company incorporated in California and with its principal place of business in Texas, et cetera. If I then go to your complaint and intervention, I see the allegation in paragraph 3 that TIG is a Texas insurance company with its principal place of business in Irving, Texas. Now, if TIG is a California corporation, as the original complaint indicates, there could be problems with you, a California corporation, in a capacity as plaintiff intervening to assert a claim against TIG.
Judge, our information at the time was that TIG was a Texas insurance corporation, and we have no reason to believe otherwise. As a matter of fact.
But didn't you file your complaint and intervention after the original complaint had been filed?
We did, Judge. As a matter of fact, the complaint was filed after the motion for summary judgment, which was granted in this case, was actually briefed. And in the response of reliable research, there is a abstract, if you will, of the TIG entities, which
but,
led...
I mean, I don't know why you wouldn't have at least wondered, if looking at the complaint, where this company... I mean, maybe we can find out where they really are incorporated, because I'm concerned... given the language of 1367, when somebody intervenes as a plaintiff and is trying to assert in that capacity something under supplemental jurisdiction, you can't violate the rules of 1332.
I understand that, Judge.
I mean, the other part of your intervention, as I understand it, was against Reliable, and that's different. You know, Reliable, we know, is Missouri.
And independent grounds for federal jurisdiction would be the federal question under the Declaratory Judgment Act.
That's not a jurisdictional statute. You need jurisdiction for the thing. You can't say, I, a citizen of Illinois, have a contract with somebody else, a citizen of Illinois. I'd like a declaratory judgment about our rights under the contract. That there's no federal jurisdiction in such a case.
Be that as it may, Judge, I still don't think the court made any finding as to the residency or domicile of TIG. And evidence was presented by Reliable that it was a Texas corporation.
Well, maybe we can clarify that, because if there's a jurisdictional problem, it's something we need to solve. But why don't you proceed and we can...
Thank you, Judge.
...to do with it.
I do not, however, represent Reliable Research, and
no,
I cannot.
But it was you represented the intervener, which is why I was worried about.
That's correct. That's correct. And I, because I don't represent Reliable, I can't explain or excuse the omission of the Lachian injunction, which was against the unauthorized practice of law on its application for errors and omissions coverage. I understand that as the intervener in this case, we have no greater rights than Reliable Research would have under that insurance contract. But instead, because this court reviews a summary judgment with the same scrutiny as the trial court did, I argue that viewing the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, the omission was neither an intentional deception or a material misrepresentation affecting the risk to be insured. This is the scrutiny under Section 154 of the Illinois Insurance Code. That's the statute that governs TIG's ability to avoid coverage for misrepresentation or a false warranty. It's never been argued in this case that there was an intentional deception, like the Home Insurance versus Dunn case where a lawyer's criminal conduct was hidden, and which is cited by the appellee. That
no.
case is not instructive.
Well, why didn't you set forth the information? Is it because you thought that it would result in a denial of coverage?
Again, Judge, I do not represent Reliable Research, and I can neither excuse nor explain why it was not set forth.
You can't explain it. All right, okay.
But there are affidavits in the record,
right,
from Ms. Melson and Mr. Quirk, who were both employees,
right,
of Reliable Research, explaining why they didn't feel it was necessary to disclose this.
But this, I thought this case had boiled down to the materiality. I didn't think that we'd really preserved any argument on appeal about whether it was a misrepresentation. The district court said, look, have any claims slash suits been made against you in the last 10 years? It's a pretty clear question. And if you say, as a matter of fact, we have a permanent injunction entered against us because of something, you fail to disclose that, you haven't answered the question. Now, materiality, I think, is the serious issue here, and the district court thought there could be no, there was no genuine issue of fact about that either, given that it dealt with the kind of business that Reliable did that was subject to the insurance policy. It's escrow, it's closing. The policy covered a lot of things. And also there was this affidavit from the underwriter.
Judge, you asked several questions and make several points. I agree that there was a misrepresentation, and the appellants have abandoned the argument that there was none. The question is exactly what you have inquired about, and that is the materiality of the omission. And Illinois law, the Hatch case, the Weinstein case that we've cited in the appellant's briefs, define the inquiry as whether reasonably careful and intelligent persons would have regarded the fact stated, or in this case omitted, as substantially increasing the chances of the event insured against so as to cause a rejection of the application or different conditions.
And don't you think the phrase the event insured against ought to be set alongside the actual policy that's written, not the particular risk under the policy that now seems to, suppose the policy covers risks 1, 2, 3, and 4, if that failure to disclose affects any of them, it's a material omission.
Judge, I wouldn't say that that's entirely correct, because the risk that causes the loss should be the scrutiny, particularly where the court is trying to determine whether summary judgment is appropriate as opposed to allowing the finder of fact to determine materiality. And that is what most of the state court decisions under Illinois law have used as a guideline, because materiality is a question of fact for the jury. And if I may please, Judge Coffey wrote a decision in Methodist Medical Center versus AMS, which was a case cited by the Apple League. This was where an applicant disclosed gallbladder surgery but remained completely silent with regard to a heart condition that eventually led to her demise. And in that particular case, summary judgment was appropriate because that was the very event that caused the loss. And by omitting the important information about the heart condition, this applicant deceived the insurance underwriter. I would submit to the court that our case is completely different. The Lachian injunction, which was an injunction against intentional illegal conduct, that is, the unauthorized practice of law, has absolutely nothing to do with searching the public records to determine whether or not a lien encumbered the title of Mortgage One, which is the loss that was ultimately paid by Security Union Title Insurance Company.
One of the losses, right? There were two claims that Reliable tendered for coverage under the policy, and one of them dealt with the unauthorized practice of law.
Which was not covered, Judge, and it never would have been covered.
It was tendered by Reliable, right? When Reliable tenders to the insurer a claim for unauthorized practice of law, Reliable is in no position to deny that prior litigation about unauthorized practice of law was material. And since you're standing in Reliable's shoes, you're just Reliable subrogee.
With regard to the Mortgage One claim,
you can't have any claims greater than Reliable.
With regard to the Mortgage One claim.
Let me put it this way. If this were just a suit between Reliable and TIG, there's no doubt that Reliable, having tendered an unauthorized practice claim, could not defend against TIG's request to cancel the policy. Reliable's admitted that unauthorized practice is material just by tendering that claim for defense. Once TIG cancels the policy vis-a-vis reliable, there are no shoes into which you can step.
Judge, I think the court...
Isn't that true?
No, it's not true.
The policy is there or not.
It's not true to the extent of the Mortgage One claim, and I think they have...
Your policy is there or not, right? The policy is different from the claims under it. If the policy can lawfully be canceled vis-a-vis reliable, then you, who take as a subrogee from reliable, have no claim.
Judge, I was unable to find any case where two claims arose at the exact same time, one which would have been undeniably rejected because it was intentional illegal conduct, and another which would have undeniably been covered because it fits squarely within the terms of the policy.
It's not covered if the policy is canceled for misrepresentation.
But, Judge, if the two claims arise at the same time and are tendered at the same time, the question becomes, is there coverage for some but not all of these events?
All right, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've used up all your time.
Including the rebuttal, right, Judge?
Yes.
Yes.
Good morning. Right. I'm Darcy Ibach on behalf of TIG Insurance Company.
And where are you incorporated?
We are incorporated in California. We advised everybody in our second amended complaint, appellant's appendix page 12. We also answered the intervening complaint,
so
appellant page
136. So how could there be subject matter jurisdiction over the intervener's complaint?
That is an interesting question.
Quite.
Interests me anyway. The intervening petition order came to my office prior to my receipt of the intervening petition. The intervening petitioner, the motion to intervene said, I'll do it as a right or permissively. The order coming from the district court said intervening petition granted, but doesn't say whether it is as a
right. Forget the district court.
All right. I would say under
the question.
Sure.
How could there be, as an original matter, subject matter jurisdiction over the intervener's complaint when there are California companies on both sides?
In the American National Bank versus Chicago Investment Corporation case, Seventh Circuit, 1984, it states if a non-diverse party comes into the case by intervention, the presence will not deprive the court of jurisdiction unless the intervener was an indispensable party.
But now it's post-1990.
We've got separate questions. Maybe we need to split them out.
Sure.
The intervention of a non-mandatory party would not strip the court of jurisdiction over the claim TIG versus reliable. It's plainly subject matter jurisdiction over that. What we've got now is the question whether there's jurisdiction over the claim TIG against security or security against TIG. And worse than that, what happened in 1984 isn't really that important anymore. We need to figure out what Section 1367 does, and it was enacted in 1994?
1990.
Okay.
Well, In re Brand prescription, Northern District of Illinois, 1996, also came back with the same comment that if a non-diverse party comes into a case by intervention, presence will not deprive the court of jurisdiction.
No. Forget about depriving the court of jurisdiction. There is plainly jurisdiction of the suit TIG against reliable.
Correct.
Or TIG against unreliable, as it ought to be named. We need to deal with whether there's jurisdiction of the dispute between TIG and security.
Well, obviously, they're not completely diverse. They're both California corporations. I don't know.
And let me just point out, just to cut through here, 1367B says if it's a diversity case to begin with, as this certainly was, the district court shall not have supplemental jurisdiction. And then it goes on, but one of the things where you don't have it is where someone is seeking to intervene as a plaintiff under Rule 24 when the supplemental jurisdiction would be inconsistent with 1332. That's the language that got me worried about your case.
I think and I think you've already made this comment with my opposing counsel, there was complete diversity between reliable and the intervener.
Right,
but as for his cross-claim against my company, TIG, as both plaintiffs, both having a California connection, I don't see that they had jurisdiction either.
So there's no jurisdiction?
And in fact, there's two separate appeals, and I believe in my statement to the court, I said, assuming there's jurisdiction under Transamerica case, which I wasn't sure that there was, that they should be consolidated. But other than some earlier case law, which apparently isn't as up to date as the rules that you're citing, there very well may not be jurisdiction for the security union appeal. and just, there may be, for the reliable.
It wouldn't just be the appeal.
Well, jurisdiction in the underlying action.
By the district court.
The subject matter jurisdiction of the underlying court.
From its inception.
From its inception. From its August 27th, 2001 intervening complaint that was granted on August 30th, 2001.
Thank you.
They've already conceded there was a misrepresentation, so I won't obviously go through that. But one of the things that they have tried to state is that it is not material because TIG insured reliable merely for faulty title work, and that's just not the case. Item 7 of the declaration page of the policies identify a number of different tasks that they're insured for in the professional services, and one is, in fact, the escrow closings. One of the five key people for the company of Reliable, all their job apparently was escrow closings, and she'd been doing it for 29 years. The fact that they were doing 900 to 1,500 closings per year, based on whether you're looking at the June 22nd or the August 26, 1999 applications, would indicate they're doing between 10 and 30 a week. And this would be very significant if, in a rush to get through their closings, they're preparing deeds because all of a sudden there isn't adequate funding for the mortgages, and they're taking it upon themselves to handwrite out deeds and then not record them is very significant. And as the district court said, that's a red flag because the business that they're in is escrow closings. The business they're in is pushing the papers through. The business they're in should not be drafting things that only lawyers can do. Now, Mr. Lachin brought this to their attention in July of 1995. The permanent injunction went into effect in November of 1995. In January of 1998, Mr. Lachin must have very little to do, ran back to the court and held them in contempt because he found them yet again in the unauthorized practice of law. Now, one would think when answering the statement, was there any misrepresentation, that the unauthorized practice of law, when you have an office in Illinois issued by the Illinois court in Swansea County where they are practicing their escrow closings would be significant. They
it's not like he was doing divorce work. I mean, they were doing unauthorized practice of law in the field of the escrow closings.
They're doing carryback deeds that they're handwriting out. I mean, it had to have been exceedingly unprofessional. And of course, they're making mistakes. They're not lawyers. They need a real estate attorney to perhaps do this. So I think it belies any conduct that they can say it's not material when they push through the initial complaint by the ISBA and Hudgens for coverage. They came to TIG for coverage. TIG did not know anything about their unauthorized practice of law until it read the complaint that was tendered to them to try to, in fact, defend them on. And then when you look in the paragraph, and it says the unauthorized practice of law, and it attaches information, the next thing you know, TIG issues a reservation of rights letter. They didn't decline coverage, but they issued a reservation of rights letter, told them to get independent counsel because there was a conflict of interest. Then, as they were sitting there preparing the declaratory judgment action on this particular matter, the second claim came in, which was the Mortgage One claim, which was, in fact, a title claim. All right. So the point is they wouldn't have had a responsibility for either of these claims if the insured had been honest, materially honest, on a very important issue. The affidavit is clear-cut. The underwriter, senior underwriter from TIG, said if I had been apprised of the fact that there was this unauthorized practice of law, there never would have been any insurance provided by TIG. Why? Because it's critical to an underwriter in the field of title and escrow, professional liability, that they not be offering insurance and quoting insurance to those entities who are preparing handwritten deeds, not recording them, and just trying to slide through 10 to 30 little closings a week so that they can get their paid fee. So there's an obvious flaw there. The Reliable also takes the position that TIG did not instruct it what was material, and I think we can all agree that the case law is uniform in saying it's not for the insured to determine what is material, it is for the insurer to determine what is material, and the most basic way is through the underwriter, although a number of cases say employees of the insurance company. But I think we all know that the underwriter's job is to assess the risk. The risk is this a qualified company? And I would direct you to the Apostolos case, the Seventh Circuit 1971, and St. Paul Reinsurance versus Williams Montgomery, Northern District 2001. They did not offer anything in contradiction of Ms. Ronan's affidavit. They did not do a motion under 56F to attempt to open up discovery. In fact, they took no discovery. They didn't ask for her deposition. They took 3 months to prepare the response to the summary judgment. Although Security Union came in late, the dispositive motion date was November 15th. To the extent Security Union wanted to offer anything different, he certainly had until November 15th to file a motion against TIG. It elected not to do so.
That affidavit did strike me as fairly conclusory, though. It just says in 16 different ways, I would have really thought this was a big deal. And over and over again, she doesn't go into, for instance, the fact that it was escrow business or the fact that this changes the risk. She didn't even say what you just did. And it did strike me as a bit on the conclusory side.
Although it's no different than a number of other cases that have decided, for instance, in the Home versus Dunn that you just heard a moment ago, the Seventh Circuit reversed the underlying case and found that when the attorney completing the application didn't identify the embezzlement of funds, the criminal activity of the embezzlement of funds, that there was a material misrepresentation of the application, and it applied to all the attorneys in the law firm. Similarly, in the Gardy versus InterOcean Insurance Company, a similar type affidavit, we just wouldn't have offered it. One of their big cases is the Crest case. It comes out of Kane County, and it's an older one against State Farm. And it was interesting because what the court there held was that at oral argument, so apparently it wasn't even at the evidence, at least according to the opinion, at oral argument, Query Hero's counsel said that it was only a factor to consider on the auto policy whether, in fact, a suspension of license would either negate or change the terms of coverage. That isn't the case here. It's, you know, there is no wiggle room here. TIG would not have offered the policy. End of story. Unauthorized practice of law, you don't get insurance for TIG. I see my lights up. May I answer anything further?
Thank you, counsel. Okay. We'll take the case under advisement and proceed.